please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Ruth B. from Katona, New York, and her home group is the Bedford Village Group. Hi, everybody. My name is Ruth. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ruth.
Thanks for having me. This is really awesome. I hope you all know how lucky this is, like being at a revival meeting or something. My group would be very impressed. It's absolutely beautiful. It's a beautiful drive down, and I have a nice little room over in Bethlehem. I took a few days off, so I'm very grateful to be asked to come and do this. My home group is Bedford Village. My sobriety date is October 19th of 1993. This past October, I celebrated 20 years, and amazingly, my sister Maria celebrated 20 years on December 31st, and my sister Lisa celebrated 20 years on January 1st. And I'll tell you a little bit about that. One of the things that we did, and we had it in mind for a while, that we would do something special to celebrate our 20th anniversary, so we went with about 9 other women to Greece in the fall. We went to all of these sacred sites where they worshiped the goddess long before there were Zeus and Athena popping out of his head. And so it was this beautiful, beautiful trip for 2 weeks. One of the places that we went to was called Delphi, and it's outside of Athens. Delphi is this beautiful place on the side of a mountain, and it was known in most history books as the Oracle of Apollo. Before that, it was really the Oracle of Gaia, the Earth Mother, and it was a place where people would come from all over the Middle East, from Europe, to come and hear prophecy. And the reason I'm bringing it up, and I've spoken about it a lot in the last 6 months, is because when we got there, now we've traveled however many thousand miles it is from New York to Greece, and it's one of the first places that we go to, and when you come there, the woman who is leading the retreat, it's like, try to imagine you've been traveling, and now this is traveling 3,000-4,000 years ago in a caravan, and it maybe takes 6 or 9 months to get there. And once you get there, the archway over the entrance to this site says, know thyself. And I was just so moved by that. Which is really, for me, it's on our coin, you know, to our own self be true. This is like one of the most ancient spiritual principles that there are. Know thyself. And she asked this question, why would it be so important if you traveled all this way? Why is it important to know thyself? And one of the things that we talked about is the oracle, the message was never like, you need to go here on Wednesday, you know, and you need to buy this many cattle for this much money. It was like very cryptic and a story usually, or some sort of riddle or puzzle. And if you didn't, she said, it's almost like if you didn't know the right question to ask, you're never going to understand how to incorporate the message into your own life. And I feel like that's what, you know, if I had to summarize what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me for the last 20 years, it's allowed me to know myself so I can hear those messages. I can hear that still small voice that sounds very different to me than it sounds to you or than it sounds to my sisters, and I know what to do with that intuition. And it's just a beautiful thing. I was so completely clueless when I got here. I really was. I had no idea what was wrong with me. I'm one of those people that, very typical, you know, I thought that I was crazy. And I can remember being 15 years old and saying to my friends, I'm probably alcoholic. I still want to stop drinking, you know. And this is what I thought. Looking back, I thought there is something completely wrong and abnormal about the way that I drink. And I knew that even then. You know, I knew that even then. What I obviously didn't understand is I just don't want to stop. So when the happy day came, 26, 9 years later or whatever, 10 years, 11, I can't do the math. How much years is that? It's 11. 11 years later, I was absolutely shocked that I couldn't stop. And as we know, there were many, many reasons to stop before the age of 26. I just didn't see them. I did not know myself. I could not, as the book says, I could not differentiate the true from the false. And I love that line. I was just reading it with a woman the other day. You know, to them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I might know that it's really not normal, but it's the only normal life that I can be living. I can look at other people and say, gosh, they graduated, they did this, they're getting responsible, they're getting married. You know, I'm just still hanging out down in this corner here waiting for something to happen. So when I finally hit my bottom, and I had gotten involved in other things that make you really super sick really quickly, I had been living out west. I moved back to New York to go to school down in Washington Heights, and I hadn't been around my family really very much in about 7 years on any kind of regular basis. And my sisters knew there was something really wrong with me, and they would ask me, "How are you?" I said, "I'm really stressed out. It's school. It's the work. It's my fiance. It's this and that." And they just kind of left me alone, and you know, they were having their little powwows. And my sister Lisa called me this one night, and she's like, "Listen, I just want to do something with you." And I was incredibly sick that particular night. I was very sick in withdrawal, and I said, "What?" And she said, "I want to do a little meditation with you." So I don't know why to this day I said yes, but I said yes. So she had me lie down on the floor of my apartment in Washington Heights, turned off all the lights, I had the phone propped up next to my ear, and she did this deep relaxation. Tighten your legs, relax your legs, until it's all the way up my body. And at the end of it, I was completely relaxed. No pain, no little bugs, no nothing. Totally relaxed. And she goes, "Now I want you to lift up your arms in the air, and I want you to," she might have said, like, "imagine a white ball of light." I have no idea really what she said. She said something along those lines to, like, ask for help, ask for guidance. And I got as far as, you know, getting my arms up in the air, and I just cracked right open. And I started sobbing uncontrollably. And I hung up the phone, and I don't know how long I lied on that floor crying. And she called me about, I don't know, 3-4 days later. "Hello? Lisa? How are you?" And it just came right out of my mouth. I said, "I'm really sick. She arranged to have me go to her friend's house, who lived in Manhattan, and then her friend took me to the train and took me up to where she lived in Westchester. And my sister will tell you, when she tells her story, that she had just had this conversation with me. She knew I was coming up, and she sat in her house trying to calculate how much more she could drink before she would be too intoxicated to come picking up at the train. And, you know, I think about that. About, I was really 12 step on my drunken older sister, and her 12 step is really what crushed her, because it was this moment of truth for her, where she saw, you know, oh my God, my sister, who she thinks is dying, right, is trying to come up here so I can help her, and I can't not drink to go get her. And that was the beginning of the truth for her. And so I ended up going into a treatment. I'll tell you what, the last night I was out, I went to an emergency room, you know, after not sleeping for like 4 days. Because I figured if you went in and told them the truth, they would give you something to sleep, which is, you know, that's the last thing you're going to do. So he told me, "Well, you can go get some Benadryl. Take 2 Benadryl. If it doesn't work, take 2 more an hour later. And here's a number of a therapist. You need to see like a drug and alcohol counselor." So I immediately took like 6 Benadryl, and I took 4 an hour later, and I slept for maybe, I don't know, 14 hours or something. And then when I got up the next day, I called that therapist. And she actually, this woman was sober for about 25 years at the time. It turns out she'd gotten sober with my aunt. So she knew my aunt, she knew my family, and I went with my mother, and we sat down in her office, and she started asking me some of those questions. And, a lot of you people knew Don Key. I love that man. And I was blessed to spend some time with him. He used to say, anytime, anywhere, an alcoholic sees the truth, it's a spiritual experience. Nobody tells you that a spiritual experience doesn't always feel good. And I sat in that room and I had a spiritual experience. And for whatever reason, I just told her the truth. So she asked, "Yeah, when did you start drinking?" "You know, I started drinking when I was 10 or 11. You know, how much did you drink? How much were you drinking by this age?" You know, by the time I was 13, I was pretty much drinking every weekend. By the time I was drinking or doing something almost 24 hours a day, and it just went on from there. And I sat there with my mother, literally right next to me, crying. And I'm just telling this woman, it's the first time I had ever said it all together. First time I had ever been willing to look at the truth. And she suggested that I go away. I needed to go away to a treatment center for a period of time. And she made all these calls. That was Monday night. There was something open Thursday, so I was going to do this in the state program until Thursday. And she introduced me to this concept of one day at a time. So I had a friend of mine. She gave me this one, gave me her number at work. She gave me her home number. She said, all you have to do is literally take this actually 1 hour at a time. You have a meeting that you're going to go to tonight. This is where you're going to go. You know where you're going. You're going with this woman, and you're going to come back here at 9 in the morning and do the day program. And if you're having trouble or you're struggling or anything like that, you call me. And I remember looking at her and being absolutely terrified, like, there's no way I'm going to make it till tomorrow morning. So she just kind of talked me through that, and I left. And I made the arrangements with my friend Dana, and she came and picked me up. And I looked at her and I just said, I don't know where you're going, but this is where I'm going, and you can come with me or not. And that was my last night out. And I'm really grateful for that. I'm grateful because I understand when they talk about we are fundamentally beyond human aid. And I know in my heart that I wanted to be sober more than I had ever wanted to be sober that night. And I wanted to stay sober until the following morning when I could come back to that program. And I was not able to do that because I had no defense. And I went the next morning and I told them. And I don't really remember what happened that day, but I do remember they had a meeting that came in from the outside. This woman, Charlotte, led the meeting. It was a second step meeting. There were maybe about 10 of us, 10 women in the room. And I'm so angry and so freaked out and sick, and you know, just sitting like in my little corner like this, and it's going around the room, and I don't understand anything that they're talking about because I don't know what the steps are, and I don't know what the second step is, and I don't know what higher power is, and I want to be there, and I want to get sober, and then it's my turn. You know, if you're new, and you ever, I just cursed insensibly, and you know, my name is Ruth, and I'm an effing and I just want to effing drink and get high. And Charlotte, who's at the top, is just sitting there like this. which is the worst thing you can do for somebody who's that pissed off. And she started to talk about her first meeting. And then she talked a little bit more about what's happened to her since that first meeting. And that miracle happened. And that miracle is certainly twofold. You know, the miracle of knowing that in that 5 minutes that she spoke, I knew that she knew exactly how badly I felt. I knew it. And more importantly, I knew that she didn't feel that way anymore. So maybe threefold. The third thing was, for whatever reason, I believed that whatever she did, I could do the same thing, and I wouldn't have to feel this way anymore. I ended up going to the treatment center, and you know, there was some. We call it the gift of desperation. I'm sure you have a similar language, right? The gift of desperation. I was just desperate enough to do whatever they said. I sat with my counselor my first day that I was there. I met her in the afternoon. This woman happened to also have gotten sober with my aunt. Crazy. And we sat down. She had the steps behind her. She started asking me questions about my history and my drinking and all of that. And I don't remember what I said, but I remember she paused at one point. She said, yeah, you know, you put more energy into drinking than you've put into any other relationship in your entire life. I was like, well, wait a second, you know, that's not exactly true. I'm engaged to be married. I'm very close with my sisters. I'm very close with my mother, blah, blah, blah. I have these three really good friends. And she just sat there and she didn't say a word, and she let me just sputter out. And I had another spiritual experience. And the experience was that I knew that no matter what happened and no matter who it was, if I had that obsession on me, there was nobody that was going to be able to stand between me and another drink or getting high or whatever I was going to do. And I looked right up the steps. I'm literally 4 days sober, 3 days sober. And I said to her, so this is about God. This is for this woman? And she said, yes, it is. You know, I sometimes hear people in my home group, and I love my home group, you know, that we don't want to scare away the newcomers. We don't want to talk about God. We might frighten them. And I'm very grateful for that woman for saying yes to me when I asked her that question. So the next thing that we talked about for however long was, I said, but I don't believe in God. And she said, that doesn't really matter. This whole idea of being willing, and she suggested that I just be willing, if I was in the morning, to get down on my knees, like we've all heard, and ask whoever it is to keep me sober for that day. And at the end of the day, to get down on my knees and to say thank you. And I kept trying to, you know, I don't want to really say I was arguing with her. I just didn't really understand how that was possible, how you can pray when you don't believe in anything. And she just, she I guess she really talked me through that. And that's what I did. And my first prayers were very much like that, down on my knees on the side of that bed, often in tears, saying, I don't know if you're there, and I don't know if you can talk to me, but please do, because I think I'm going to die. And you could almost say, you know, they were the most sincere prayers that I've prayed in the last 20 years that I've been here, with no real belief, only with willingness and a lot of pain. And my experience of coming to have a relationship with my Creator came out of that willingness with no faith and no belief. And I've sponsored all kinds of women over the years, self-declared atheists and agnostics and Wiccans and every form of formal religion. And I have to really say, I've never worked with anybody that has not come to a place where they've been willing to consider the possibility, you know, like we say, it's a mustard seed. Are you willing to consider the possibility that there might be something that could heal you of this deception? And I got out, I joined a group right away, I got a sponsor, I started working with my sponsor. She did not practice the steps of the book. That wasn't anything. I think in the rehab, the direction I was given with the book was read chapter 5. And you don't know what the hell they're talking about. So God makes use of what's at hand, and I developed this really nice little crush on this young man in another group, and you're not supposed to be dating anyone, but really, I had a big crush on this man, and he introduced me to a sponsor who happened to be somebody that was very much involved in the book. With this man Joe when I was about 6 months sober. And I remember, you know, my first group, they were very step oriented, used the 12 and 12, and I appreciate that, and it was helpful for me. When I did my third step in that group, about 15 women in my home group brought me up into our little upper room in our church, and they went around a circle, and they each shared their own experience of step 3. And then my sponsor gave me the big book, and she said, if you feel that you're ready, we'd like to bear witness while you said your third step prayer. And it was absolutely a beautiful, beautiful experience. And I think, you know, sometimes I think the sponsor is just a glorified witness. That's really all we are, is just a glorified witness. I am just literally holding space for you while you have this experience and sharing my own when it's appropriate. It was beautiful. And then I went to write that fourth step, and the direction that I got was write down everything that ever bothered you. And that was very easy to do because there were a lot of things that bothered me. And I wrote it down. I sat with my sponsor. I read it to her. And she handed me a little index card that had the 7 deadly sins on it. And she had made check marks, I guess, based on what I had read to her. And then I was on step 6. And it was the first time in 6 months that I had no idea. I felt I didn't understand what was going on. I really believe, for me, I had the experience, even though I hadn't really read the book or gone through it that way, I had had an experience with 1, 2, and 3, really with 1 and 2, that first day sitting in the office of my counselor in treatment, that I was crushed by the truth of my powerlessness, and I came to believe that there was a power, and I began to seek that power that day. And then the third step, I really believe, happened in that room. So this is why I love the book. My experience was, I wrote that fourth step that way, and it really didn't show me anything. So when I came on 6, I had no idea what's going on, because I never really properly looked at myself. I never did a thorough house cleaning, as the book says. And I went on that retreat, and I came back from that retreat, and I said to my sponsor, I know why I'm having such a hard time with step 6. write another fourth step like it's outlined in the big book. And I think I was talking to Shelley, there were not a lot of women where I was 20 years ago that were working, but there were not a lot of people, period, where I lived. And I lived 5 minutes from Stepping Stones. And there were very, very few people that did the steps out of the book, and my sponsor was like, that's absolutely fine, you do that, and then you can get yourself a new sponsor. So, you know, God bless her, because I really had a beautiful conversation with my daughter today, and she's 17, she's getting ready to go to college, not this year, but she's going to be a senior this year, so she's starting to really look at that stuff, and she's feeling overwhelmed about the weight of this decision, and it's going to affect her whole life, where she goes, and what she's going to do, and oh my God, and very intense, and she's like, but you know, actually, the truth is, even if it's not like where I should be, it's where I should be because I'll be there. And I'll go somewhere else. That's not where I'm supposed to stay because that's how life is. I'm like, dang, okay. Yes, that is correct. So I had that sponsor for a reason. And that sponsor was the woman who was in that second step meeting. That was my first sponsor, Charlotte. She was wonderful. And so I had to get a new sponsor. And the only woman that was sponsoring in Ruth, I don't know why this happened. There was another woman who had been sober with my aunt. She was like 20-some-odd years sober, and she was basically like, listen, honey, I don't have that experience. If that's what you feel like you need to do, then you do that. They had this man, Bob, who brought me to the workshop with Joe. They brought like 10 other guys, and they all, after the workshop, they started a little Friday night workshop near our group. My sponsor Charlotte was sure that I was only there chasing boys, which was a very reasonable accusation on her part, but it really wasn't. I really wanted to do this work, and I wrote my fourth step like it's outlined in the book. I had no idea how resentful I was. I would have never in a million years identified myself as an angry person or somebody that holds grudges or anything like that. I really believe that I didn't care enough about you to hold a grudge toward you. And I started writing, and it was my first grade teacher. It was the two girls in first grade. It was the people in second grade. It was, you know, extending it to the parts like every boyfriend that I ever had, every girl that they ever dated before or after they were my boyfriend. And then like, I wrote, I resented girl in a bar on First Avenue who went home at 6 when I was just taking home. I didn't even know this woman's name, and I never even spoke to her, but she showed up on my Instagram story because I was so resentful that she had done this. And I remember in the fifth step, because I read it to my sponsor, and I also read my fifth step to Bob, I had several resentments like that one. And he kind of paused at one point, and he's like, geez, you just really hate all women, don't you? And he was right. And what did I see at the bottom of that? I am so threatened by all women. And I like I said, you know, I don't know that stuff. I have no idea that that's how I operate. Everyone knows that as a man does pray, whatever, fill in the blanks. You know, and then there were those, as they say, fancy to real. I had real, you know, there's the real harm where I was really hurt, and that whole process of setting aside the other person involved entirely, right? I think that is what separates the women from the girls. I mean, they get 6 and 7. I think that is what separates the women from the girls. Can I set aside the other person involved entirely, right? Literally. Flip the page and resolutely look for my own mistakes. That is like superhuman to be able to do that. And I think, again, Don used to say, you could write 5 notebooks full of resentment in between. If you don't have an experience with that prayer between the third and the fourth column, it doesn't really, it's not going to mean anything. You know, it really isn't. You know, I might look at it, and I did this. I got a lot of it. There were still some, especially those ones where I felt I was really hurt, where, you know, I kind of saw what I did, and yet it was still related to what they did. You know, I wouldn't have called you a B-I-T-C-H if you hadn't socked me in the whatever. You know, and that took a long time to really be able to do that fully, but that was my intention, to set aside the wrongs others had done. And I saw, you know, I saw that, you know, when all was said and done, fundamentally, I am only concerned with my own emotional security. That is the bottom line. I didn't want to be helpful, and I didn't want to do all those things. could never forgive him for that. My father died when I was 19 years old, and the best I could come up with while he was getting sick was to get strung out on his morphine. And didn't even know I was strung out until he died and all the medicine was gone. And I kept telling my mama, I swear I'll go to the hospital tomorrow. I will go tomorrow. I swear to you I will go tomorrow. You know, looking at that whole experience and looking at the kind of child that I was and the way that I disrespected him and the way that I disrespected my mother and how I pushed him and drove him. Experience thinking about what he was going through, thinking about what my mother was going through, my sisters, my brother, none of them. It was like, I don't like the hospital, I don't like the way it smells, and I'm too sick, and I want to go live with my friends. And then you get to come out from under that. You get to come out and see the truth of that. This is who I am, left to my own devices. This is who I am running the show. I wrote the fear inventory. That was also shocking. I got a great piece of advice. I know I'm somewhat preaching to the crowd here. For me, it was a novelty to write down everything I'm afraid of and then write down right after it all of the opposites. And I'm afraid of having a relationship, and I'm afraid of being alone, and I'm afraid of success, and I'm afraid of failure, and following that. There are these very small handful of fears which just cripple me every day. You know, I'm afraid of pain, I'm afraid of being alone, I'm afraid of dying, I'm afraid there is no God. God used to call it the little worm. You know, maybe this is all smoke and mirrors. And that beautiful prayer of, direct my attention toward what you would have me be, not what you would have me do. I was really blessed to do a big book study with about 10 women last summer. And it was really just awesome. And when I went through the fourth step with them and was doing 6 and 7, but really doing that fourth step, and I wrote my fear inventory, I would sit with, I don't know, I'm sure it's been suggested to me, I've never done this before. I sat with each fear and I said that prayer, God, please remove my fear of intimacy and direct my attention toward what you would have me be. And I would just sit and I would wait to hear whatever that voice was. Down whatever came to me. God would have me be trusting. God would have me be kind. God would have my heart be open. And it was a really beautiful experience. I've done things like that, but for whatever reason, which is why I love the fact that we get to continue to go through these steps, it was a much deeper experience and resulted in much deeper trust for me in that process. I'll just share one experience about the sex conduct inventory. I was telling some people, I was blessed to sponsor a woman whose father was the archivist at Stepping Stones. So she literally grew up at Stepping Stones, and her mother was sober for a long time also, and she grew up with all of the picnics and the people, and she's just as alcoholic as the next person. And when we were doing her fifth step together, you know, you think you're giving people directions, and then there's what actually happens and what they do. And I'm sure this happened to me many times. So she came back and we went to do her fifth step, and she got out her paper and she started reading me her sex conduct inventory. And it was classic, like, I want him to be kind, and I want him to have a spiritual practice, and I want him to love being outside, and I want him to enjoy the arts, and blah, blah, blah. And, I mean, he was just fantastic, whoever he was going to be when he showed up. And I said, wow, that's really fantastic. I just want you to do one little thing, and can you read it to me again? And so I just want to use the first person. Right? But she's sitting there, and she's reading. She's like, I want to have a spiritual practice. I want to be kind. I want to be creative. And she just started, people were just weeping. You know, it's like this beautiful thing. It's not about that. This is about who I get to become. I don't even think, it's really about not even who I get to become, it's about who I am. At that, I don't know if it was at that first retreat I went to, but this man really who thought about the fourth step, like whatever your favorite jewel or stone or whatever it's like, just imagine what that is. So it's that a thing for me. Thank you. 4 and 6 and 7 and 8 and 9, that stuff gets removed. And it's not like God comes in. I really feel like for me, it's that God gets to shine out of me. Joe used to also say, you know, I believe in a God that is closer to me than my own breath. And that's really what I need. I need that. I need that kind of power in my life on a daily basis. So then I did 6 and 7, and I did them in an hour, and I totally got it. And I went on to 8 and I left, and I had a very long list of them. I had a very long inventory. And I had really sort of bottomed out in Seattle and then moved back to New York to go to school, and that's where I actually had my last drink. So I ended up planning a trip to go out there, and I was going to go to these places that I drank at and be around people that I bought drugs from and ex-boyfriends and all this. And I went through it step by step with my friend Bob, and I remember thinking, like, it's going to be terrifying being in these places, you know. And he just kind of reminded me, you know, you are in this mantle of protection. You're out there doing God's work. This is the purpose of your being there, and that's what you're going to do. And I went on this whirlwind, like 5 days of making appointments and making amends. And we could talk about amends for an hour easily. I'll tell you two amends that struck me. I made amends with one ex-boyfriend. And I said what I mean. I was taught cards. I went over each one with my sponsor to kind of role play. I was as specific as I could be in 8. And then I was kind of taught when I go to approach the person, I'm not going to say, and then I lied to you about this, and then I slept with these people, and blah, blah. I'm going to really say, I'm going to try to be as general as possible unless they're really asking me for specifics that I, you know, I never could give you the kind of dignity and respect you deserve. I was not capable of being honest. I always looked out for my own welfare, that kind of thing. And I sat and had this talk with this man, and I said everything I needed to say and asked him, you know, is there anything that I'm not aware of that you want to talk about? And he said to me, you know, I would have had the baby and I would have married you. And I had an abortion. And I had never one time occurred to me that that was something that I should make amends to him for or that I should even bring it up. I never remember having a conversation with him at the time. Not once. Not a single time. And that was a beginning of a healing process for me with that, which is something that, you know, you don't talk about so much. I had a baby a year before I had that abortion, and at the time, I was pregnant, I was stupid enough to get pregnant, I was raised Catholic, so I thought I would give the baby up for adoption. You know, I sort of missed the no premarital sex teaching, but I was okay with the, you know, I will have this baby and I will give it up, and I gave my son up for adoption, and that worked so well a year later when I was with this next man and I had an abortion. And I say that, like, for myself, and I really mean this only for myself. It was just like another, you know, alcohol just took everything a tiny little piece at a time, and then occasionally these big huge chunks. And so I was able to kind of set that right with him, and then over the years was able to really make peace with myself for that experience. Another amend that I made out there, or tried to make, I had lived with this woman. I had really treated her horrendously, and she refused to see me. I was just stunned. She didn't want to have anything to do with me. She didn't want to accept the amends. Fine. Another woman that we had lived with, she accepted the amends. We sat and talked. She said, you know, Ruth, I can forgive you, but I will never forget the fact that you ruined my wedding. No. Okay, they're not all like happy, fuzzy, really excellent amends stories. I have a lot of those, but those were some experiences that I had out there. I'll tell you, 2 years later, almost to the month, that woman who refused to see me called me. And one of the first things that she said to me was, I just really want to thank you for giving me some time to heal. You know, of course, I still have the monkey mind that's like, you're, you know, blah, blah, blah. I was ready, you know, it's all about you, but I just said, you're welcome. You know, and I was quiet and I listened. Don used to always tell me too, you know, you get, in the end, you get one shot. I'm going to say what I need to say. I'm not a doormat, but I'm going to say what I'm aware of, and then I'm going to sit and I'm going to listen. And it might be that what I hear is not the truth, or it's their perception of the truth, and the truth is somewhere in the middle of our perceptions. So but I'm going to sit there and I'm not going to correct them and I'm not going to fix them and I'm not going to challenge them. I'm going to sit there and I'm going to listen. That doesn't mean that the amends have to be whatever, you know, I mean, it has to be an amend. It has to be spiritually centered. But I've had those experiences. When I got back from that trip, my friend Peter picked me up at the airport. I remember sitting outside of my house and I was like crying, you know, because I had had a lot of really beautiful, even the experiences that were difficult were wonderful. You know, I knew that I had made the effort. I had made the attempt and that I stood willing to do whatever it would be to set those matters right if I could. And he sat on the steps with me and he took out the big book and he started to read me the 10-step promises. And I realized I had been out in all these bars and found people that were still drinking, and that's a good place you can still find some of these people, so that's where I went. And not once the entire time I was there did it occur to me to drink. Not a thing. I didn't even think about not drinking when I was out there. And I'm reading those promises and I know that they're happening for me. You know, it has been removed. With no thought or effort on our part. I could have argued a little bit with that. Are you kidding me? All the effort that I put in, I, you know, blah, 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 but I got it. And then move on to 11. Step 11, I almost say at this point, I'm 20 years sober. The first 7 years, I spent a lot of my spiritual practice was kind of going to big book retreats. I would go see different people, Don or Joe or these other people that were just wonderful, and spend the weekend. I've kind of always known about myself. I need to retreat. I tend to be really introverted in that. So I go, like, you know, every couple of months I retreat. I go on a spiritual retreat with other people of like mind. I pursued all different kinds of books. What I was kind of told is this is a spiritual playground. You know, go find what calls to you. Explore Buddhism. Explore Christianity. Explore pagan whatever. Whatever it is that draws your attention is what you want to explore. And I did. I've spent various amounts of time over the years being very vigilant and disciplined with the book. You know, upon you know. Awakening where I've done that, and then other times it's not working for me and I need to do some other kind of nightly review or upon awakening. And I really believe that, especially with the women I sponsor. I'll give them stuff that I'm reading or listening to. There are fantastic tapes to just explore whatever it is that your heart is calling to. And then, you know, it's really the truth. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, my experience is that by the time I got to step 12, I was dying to sponsor women. You know, you get saved from the jaws of hell, and the normal response is to want to go find somebody else and see if you can help them. When I was in college and the Jehovah's Witnesses would come, I would get so excited because I would just be so nasty and I would make up these absolutely outlandish stories to tell them when they came to the door, just trying to shock them and, like, you know, that I was a hooker and that I, you know, whatever, I had five boyfriends and three girlfriends. Just terrible because they just offended me so much. And I would say to myself, like, I hope there's no Jehovah's Witnesses here. I'm sorry. Let me finish the story. Okay, so I would say, like, these people are so desperate that they have to go out door to door and try to convince other people to believe what they believe. It's the most pathetic thing I've ever seen. And then, you know, I get sober, and I have this spiritual awakening, and I am desperate to go out door to door and find people to share my experience with. And I literally, at one point, I had that experience. I was like, I'm just like the Jehovah's Witnesses, you know? And I got it. Like, I got for them, maybe they were having such a beautiful experience with their faith that they simply wanted to share it. And I believe that. And that's kind of what sponsor. I mean, it is an honor. It's like Silkworth says in the doctors, it is a privilege to be able to share our stories, to be able to share our experience with other people. It has been, you know, one of the highlights of my life to have been able to work with women in the steps. I tried once working with a man, and that did not work very well for me. I will tell you that much. I had a complete spiritual crisis at 15 years sober after we started. You know, he professed his love for me in the middle of his fifth step, and It's really a terrible story. It's not a terrible story because it's my daughter said it's what meant to happen. But you know that I don't do that anymore. Let's just leave it at that. I don't do that anymore, and he's doing all right. But I have I'll just say also regarding some more amends and things like that. My son that I had given up for adoption turned 21 about 4 years ago, and I was working with this was after this whole spiritual crisis with sponsoring this man and that whole thing blowing up. And the beautiful thing about that experience for me is that I stayed tucked into AA. I got a new sponsor. I had women that just loved me to death. I mean, I really, I so violated what I believed were my moral principles by dating this man who was still in his first year. And it was crushing. It was like this experience of everything that I thought I believed was torn out from under me. And I can say now, looking back at it, I'm so grateful for that experience. You know, the job of the ego is to reconstruct itself. So, you know, little Miss Poster Child, AA, blah, 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 it's just absolutely crushed. And that's a very powerful, very humbling experience. I think like the book says, if sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into working with others. In that, within a month of when this relationship ended, I had three women ask me to sponsor them. And they didn't know, you know, and I'm thinking, it's also one of those beautiful lessons, I'm thinking when I am at my absolute worst and have nothing to offer, these women just show up. So that's got to be another lie that I tell myself, another old idea that I need to set aside. You know, the truth is, I was more open, more vulnerable, more surrendered during that time than I had been in many years because of that. And ultimately, those kinds of experiences, if I can be honest, if I can know myself, they're a beautiful opportunity for compassion. You know, all the judgments that I have about others, those kinds of things. I was going to go to my business meeting the other night, and I was going to share under gripes and resentments that I was not happy with how bullying some of the members in our group had been. And that was what I was going to share in that portion of the meeting. And I swear, this is the truth. Get to some sort of new business, and somebody brings up something, and I was like, well, excuse me, isn't that already the group conscience? And they're like, yes. I'm like, but, and I just went after this guy, and then somebody else who was sitting next to me, who I happened to find, she's like, I think we're group unions today, and this thing was, and I just started laughing. You know, I'm literally, this is my plan at the business time. I'm going to tell these men, you got to stop being such a bully. And it just comes spewing right out of my mouth. And I'm telling you, I don't think I'm a bully. I really honestly don't think that. But it's like almost. So we get to have those kind of experiences. And my son, I'm working with a new sponsor after this experience happens. And we're going through the steps together again. And she asked me why I have not made contact with my son or how that happened. And I had thought for a long time when he turns 21, I'm gonna try to write him a letter and maybe I'll try to reach out if it's been an open adoption. And I've experienced in my second month of sobriety in my home group meeting. It was a beginner's meeting. I don't know what happened or how the conversation was going, but I had the thought that one of the reasons that I had given up my son for adoption is because I did not want to stop drinking. And that was a new experience. That was a new experience with some truth about myself. That's not the only reason, but that is a lot of the reason. I was not ready to stop drinking. So I wrote this letter and I sent it to the agency, and the long and short of that was the woman came back and she said, we have not found your son living independently, so you need to petition through his parents. And what living independently meant, to be my guess, is he was in jail. So she could not, and I thought, well, the first thought is, like, that's got to be my son. I'm sure it is. So I ended up meeting him about 6 months later. And I flew out to Oregon where he was, his parents. Came down, we spent 3 days together. It was one of the most magical experiences of my life. And my daughter Ramona just went and spent a week with him by herself for the first time. And he just called me about 3 weeks ago, and he's really having a hard time. And he asked me if I thought it might be okay if he came and stayed here for a little while. You know, it's just, you can't make up what happens here. Can I make amends for that? And he and I have had some really hard conversations, and we've had sponsor and the help of prayer totally cleanly. I did not need him to respond. I did not need anything from him. What I wanted to do was to make myself available to him. And I think that's part of the reason why it worked the way that it did. Because he knew I wasn't looking for anything. So it's just been incredible. The last story that I will tell you is my favorite amended story. I guess my daughter was about 8, so this is going on almost 9 years ago. And I was in nursing school when I got sober. I went back to nursing school in sobriety. I got the first job that was offered to me on a cancer floor, and then I ended up becoming a hospice nurse when my daughter went to school. And I am blessed beyond measure to be able to do this kind of work. And I met this one woman who was a patient of mine. I felt madly in love with this woman. I have no idea why. Her name was Anna. And we used to just sit and talk. You know, it's a joke. Every professional boundary that I was supposedly practicing was completely out the window. I would come and take her blood pressure and then just put my stuff away, and we would sit and have a cup of tea. This has never happened before, and it's never happened since. There's just something about this woman that I just loved, and for whatever reason, she loved me. And as she was getting sicker, she kept telling me, "I really want to meet your daughter. I really, really want to meet your daughter." And I'm like, "Yeah, I can't. My daughters are like, "You really need to bring Ramona over." And, you know, I don't even tell any patients that I have children, let alone that I have a daughter and her name is Ramona. And so finally, I don't know why, I just said, "Fine." I said, "I'm going to bring her over." So I brought Ramona over, and her daughter, she's very sick at this point, and they had, like, curled her hair and gotten her all out of bed, and she was sitting dressed in this chair, and it was a very brief, short visit. It was like 45 minutes long. And nothing spectacular happened. She just kept showing where she had all these little trinkets and tchotchkes, and she said, "Oh, Ramona, this is from this story, and this is that story, and you can take anything you want." And she just interspersed, "You know, your mother, she's like the best nurse I've ever had. You know, your mother, she's just fantastic." She just kept saying these little things like that. And then we left. And I'm driving home, you know, and it occurs to me that is the only reason that this woman wanted me to bring my daughter there, so she could tell her what an amazing woman I was, right? And I think about, you know, and I'm thinking about my father, and I'm thinking about, you know, the best I could do when my father was sick, and how does this happen? How do we even get here, right? We have support, and for our staff, and I go to support, and I'm sharing this story with the counselor and with the other woman, and the counselor looks at me. Like, "Well, don't you see what you did?